This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
We recently ran a couple of programs on autism. One was about young people, the other about adults. I was also looking for people who could talk to me about seniors with autism. Well, I'm still looking and making a little progress on that. But in the meantime, I had a conversation with someone who has a job that I find fascinating. She runs support groups for caregivers.
Well, caregiving is definitely not for sissies.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about caregivers, the people who help them, and how they all get by day to day. We'll also hear how a partnership between Fulbright Canada and a state university is strengthening U.S.-Canadian relations. And we'll spend an academic minute learning how SNAP benefits are keeping people out of the emergency room. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Margaret Giralt is the activity supervisor for the Council on Aging in West Florida. Her job involves visiting various senior dining sites around the region, planning activities, scheduling speakers. She also runs the various support groups for caregivers in the region. Since this is the Council on Aging, she mainly deals with people who take care of family members with dementia or Alzheimer's disease, but there are also groups for people who care for the disabled, even groups for grandparents who are raising grandchildren. I sat down with Margaret Giralt at her office in Pensacola to talk about the issues she deals with when trying to support caregivers.
Well, in the regular caregiver support groups, generally we have people that come in very stressed out because they're dealing with their mom or their dad in early stages of dementia or some sort of physical ailment that they're having to take care of 24/7. And they don't know what to do. They're just out there by themselves. So when they come into a group of people that are already dealing with those situations, their stress level reduces just knowing they're not in it alone. And then we are able to provide speakers on different topics that are relevant to them, anywhere from someone in the field of aging that deals with Alzheimer's disease and is on the cutting edge of all the treatment, all the way down to how can I get mom to take a bath. So home health care agencies come in and talk about those particular issues, too. So there's just a wide range of different topics.
It's interesting you say their stress level goes down. There must be a lot of stories swapped before the meeting begins.
Well, and during the meeting, that's part of some of the meetings, that's all it is. You know, this is my situation. I don't know how to get the keys away from Dad. He still wants to go drive. Or what do I do when they're going out of the house and at night and I can't tie them down? What am I supposed to do? So just a variety of topics, some that you can figure out and some that you can't even imagine. But by the time they leave, at least, if nothing else, they know they're not in it alone.
You say you have home health care aides come in and give some talks there. Do you ever do these with professional home health care aides? Try to solve their problems?
We do. Well, home health care agencies, of course, there are numbers of them in the area. And they do come in. They tell what they do in the community, anywhere from giving baths to people to medication assistance.
I was thinking more of, hi, I'm Bob. I work for Jim's Home Health Care Agency, and I'm just here as Bob saying, oh, the people I had to deal with at work today.
Well, they don't usually come in with those kinds of issues. Like maybe they have their own little groups in their agencies. But for the most part, when they come in as, how can I help you? Not, this is what I see every day, and how can you help me?
There's got to be a lot of dealing with family dynamics when it comes to caregivers. I mean, just from my own experience, it seems like there's always one person in the family who gets it all on their shoulders.
Right. Well, caregiving is definitely not for sissies. So, and that is true. There's usually one person in the family that, even from childhood, maybe has been, he's the one that always has his head on his shoulders and knows how to work through situations. Or she's the one that can manage the money. Or she's the one that's more compassionate. So it kind of trickles, you know, down, as you would say, to who's the best capable of taking care of the situation. It has to be somebody that has a great attitude, that has to have compassion, that is resilient, it's realistic, and somebody that's not going to be easily, depressed about having to take care of a situation. So family meetings are good in the beginning to take a look at all the different dynamics in the family, who's going to be the one to take care of mom, who's going to be the one to take care of dad, or the best case scenario is we'll all work together and here's the schedule. But that doesn't always work.
Is there a certain age of people that you deal with, or is it just run the gamut?
Well,
the caregivers, not the
Yes. Generally speaking, the caregivers are older. I would say most of the caregivers I deal with are 60 and older. But there are some younger, depending on what the situation is. Of course, with Alzheimer's disease, there's early onset Alzheimer's, and there's physical disabilities and people that are way younger than what you would normally think a caregiver would be ready to deal with. But yeah, the age should vary, but generally over 60, I would say, are my caregivers.
Are there different concerns for people who are dealing with a family member with Alzheimer's as opposed to dealing with someone with a disability who isn't mobile?
Well, absolutely, because the physical disabilities also, although are bad, generally speaking, most people that are just suffering from some physical ailment have all their capacity to consent still, and that may be even a little harder than dealing with someone that doesn't have the capacity to consent, because they're going to be more likely to argue with the kind of care that you think they should get versus what they should have. And then the people that are dealing with folks with dementia and Alzheimer's disease, is a whole different dynamic, of course. One of the books that we recommend people to read is The 36-Hour Day, because that kind of speaks to a 24-hour plus caregiver, where you're always answering the same questions over and over again with someone who is in the late stages of dementia. You're always battling with what you can get them to do and what they won't do, eating, sleeping, you know, taking medication. So all different kinds of dynamics there, but I would say there is a little bit of difference between just dealing with someone with a physical ailment versus the cognitive problems.
If you were to have a bunch of caregivers in the room right now, and I asked them this question, my life would be so much easier if someone would just, what would they say?
Getting the right kind of care in the home to keep their loved one in the home as long as possible, as long as is reasonable, I should say. And that's a challenge, because if insurance won't pay for the kind of care they need, and they don't have the money to do it, that's a big, big problem. That's where we come in, trying to provide services in the home. So I would think that if they could have all of the care for their loved one in the home, giving them some respite out of the home, I think that's the biggest need.
I would imagine getting that break a few times a week must be something that is dear to them.
Well, it's something that we kind of say over and over again, you need to take care of yourself, and it's kind of redundant, and people don't want to hear that, because they also have a sense of guilt about, I'm the only one that can care for mom. So how can I go out and have a good time when I'm feeling guilty about what's going on with them?
Talk a little about early onset Alzheimer's. This has to be something that surprises not only the person with the condition, but the caregiver. Like, you know, I didn't sign up for this.
Well, I just recently read the book Still Alice, which is about early onset Alzheimer's, and it kind of hit home, because the woman in the book, of course, is my age, and it's the kind of situation where you're beginning to question your own cognitive abilities when you're reading something like that, because it starts out so subtle. It's scary to know that this disease can hit you at any age, and it's progressive and degenerative. So it's a scary thing. It really is, for somebody in their 50s to begin not only not knowing what this piece of paper is, but not knowing what you should do with it, you know. So it's just really, really scary. I haven't had a lot of caregivers come in talking about early onset Alzheimer's with the people they take care of, but I have shown them the film, and it makes them more ready to recognize symptoms in the people they care for or in themselves.
When someone comes in to see you the first time, what do you talk to them about?
Well, I generally, I I say, tell me what your situation is. Let's hear what your situation is. And then by knowing what they're dealing with, I know where to carry the conversation. Generally speaking, after they finish telling what's going on with them, I give them a broad overview of the Council on Aging services, because most of the services that we provide are going to hit them at some point. They're going to need the services that we provide, so we immediately try to plug them into whatever we can provide and then try to reach out in the community to other services. So first thing is, tell me what your situation is. What can we do to help you? And then we go from there.
In the end, do most caregivers end up having to put somebody into a facility?
In the end, yes. For the most part, they do. A lot of them, even if they go to facilities and they get to the end stages of Alzheimer's or dementia, sometimes they prefer to bring them back home and have hospice care come in, or hospice care can be called into facilities too. So that's where they are. So that they struggle with that again because of the guilt of putting them into a facility. But a lot of times once they do it, then they realize they're getting better care there. I'm taking better care of myself, just visiting them two or three times a week rather than being their 24-hour caregiver. So, yes, we do have information for them, too, about the assisted living as well as skilled nursing care in the area, and able to provide them and hook them up with different facilities, too.
After that happens, do they still come see you?
Oh, yes. In fact, this last year we lost a lot of our folks to death, and some of the caregivers even have returned to the meetings after that. In fact, I had a little meeting, kind of a remembrance meeting for some of the ones that we lost a few months back, and it was very, very healing, I think, not only for them, but for new people that came in to hear those stories and hear how much it helped to come in and talk to people in similar situations.
So you're building your own little community here.
Absolutely.
All right. Interesting, you mentioned grandparents raising grandchildren. That's got to be a whole different kind of support group, isn't it?
It is. I often say, although some people would see it as negative and depressing to go and hear people talk about their concerns, it really puts your life into perspective when you're sitting around the table hearing all these situations, talking to these folks. Grandparents raising grandchildren is a growing trend in the state of Florida as well as the United States. We have a group at a school in Navarre, because it was more convenient when they dropped the grandchildren off to stay for an hour rather than trying to come again to an evening meeting. But we also do provide that option, the evening meeting here, and we provide child care for that meeting. Again, we have a wide range of situations going on there, too, between people that have just taken, not necessarily even custody, but just taking care of their grandchildren because of a dynamic in their adult children's lives, all the way to people that have made the decision to adopt their children and that their grown children have given up parental rights. So again, we have speakers come in. In fact, next month we're going to have an attorney come in and talk about family law issues. That's a big question in the grandparents raising grandchildren support groups, is how do I get help? How do I get custody of my grandchild when my adult child is not willing to give up parental rights? What am I supposed to do? So the big discussion in the past few months has been grandparents' rights in the state of Florida. So we've been writing the congressman and trying to get some answers about that, because technically the laws in the state of Florida say it's best for the children to be with their birth parents. If you said that to the grandparents, they would say, oh, but I'm their parent. I'm taking care of them. Why can't the law change? It's a whole different dynamic, but again, it puts a lot of things into perspective for you if you just come and sit in one of those meetings.
Margaret Giralt is the Activity Supervisor for the Council on Aging in West Florida. You can learn more about support groups in your area at ncoa.org. Still to come, a university partnership in Northern New York is helping with U.S.-Canadian relations. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. The State University of New York at Plattsburgh is about 25 miles south of the Canadian border, and the university's Center for the Study of Canada is a national resource center on Canada. SUNY Plattsburgh has maintained a long-term relationship with Fulbright Canada. Dr. Michael Hawes is the chief executive officer of the Foundation for Educational Exchange between Canada and the U.S. and the executive director of Fulbright Canada. He was in Plattsburgh recently and talked to the Best of Our Knowledge's Pat Bradley about the relationship between the two countries and the importance of that local Canadian studies program.
There is a major center for the study of Canada here, a major center for the study of Quebec here, and we have a group of individuals, Dr. Kirkey and Dr. Etling and others on campus, who profoundly believe that the North Country's economic and social future is inextricably linked with Canada.
We're linked, but when you take a look at what's going on in Washington, are there threats to that linkage?
Of course. There are threats every day to all of our relationships, and we have two choices. We can succumb to those threats, or we can find those challenges, work with them, and move forward.
How?
The two countries have different, we're at a different moment in our history, ideologically, politically, perhaps socially. The challenge is to embrace the fact that change is occurring. Every new administration in Washington comes with her own agenda. Our challenge is to find our common purposes. It's going to be a little more difficult, perhaps, than the last time out, because there was an easier path to that, but it is what it is. We need to find a way forward.
How do the Fulbright Scholars help do that?
So Fulbright Scholars, our principal role in the world is help to encourage, develop, and sustain mutual understanding. Our scholars are doing their own research, focusing on big and important issues, but at the same time, they're building relationships. They're developing mutual understanding. They're reminding Americans, the Canadians coming here, and Americans coming to Canada, that we share a lot of common values. There are challenges in the relationship, but to be honest, that represents a very small portion of the relationship. We need to focus on where we can come together, where we share values, where we share priorities. The hard question for me is, how do we avoid short-term conflict? How do we avoid dealing with the challenges? So, for instance, my government is particularly focused on science and climate change and issues related to migration. These are not items that the current U.S. administration campaigned on, and we're going to find some differences there. And I think we have to learn to respect each other's views, even though that might be difficult. My government, as far as I understand it, welcomes immigration. We are a country that is very much focused on welcoming new Canadians, understanding that they come from a different place. Right now in America, there's some concern that there are challenges to the American way of life and challenges to American jobs. And those fears are real. We shouldn't dismiss them. But there's a lot of differences there. Some of the key issues are going to be energy, trade, economic development. Those are the issues that both governments think are important. And the question is, can we align those priorities? So I think on energy, probably. The Trump administration seems sympathetic to an increase in pipelines and a more open border with respect to the movement of energy goods and indeed services. I think the other ones are going to be a little more challenging. We're going to see a situation where the U.S. government is going to be looking at existing trade agreements. Those agreements have been very good to both countries, but they're dated. You know, NAFTA is more than 25 years old, so it's time to think about how we update that and bring it up to speed. And, you know, honestly, there's going to be a different set of expectations on each side of the border. I think both of us need to invest some time in understanding our partners' goals, desires, priorities, challenges, political realities. Mr. Trudeau is in charge of a country that has a particular historical reality. Mr. Trump is responsible for a country where they've found some challenges recently and where he's given voice to some of those concerns. Understandable. My goal as an educator and as a promoter of mutual understanding is for both of us to maybe do a little more homework, maybe do a little more work, and try to understand what's happening in the other place.
During his visit, Dr. Michael Hawes renewed an agreement with the college for 3 years that brings distinguished Canadians on short-term visits to SUNY Plattsburgh. Reporting for The Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Pat Bradley.
They used to call it food stamps. Now it's SNAP. Whatever you call it, the program keeps people out of the emergency room. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Do SNAP benefits reduce ER visits? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Colleen Heflin, professor in the School of Public Affairs at the University of Missouri, looks into this question.
The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program is a federal program that aims to address food insecurity. According to the USDA, SNAP benefits reduced the incidence of extreme poverty by 13% between 2000 and 2009. But can SNAP benefits also be beneficial in reducing visits to the emergency room? Our study, recently published in Public Health Nutrition, aimed to answer that question by analyzing the relationship between the SNAP benefit amount and occurrence of emergency room visits for hypoglycemia. Our research team used administrative program data from the Missouri SNAP and Medicaid programs to identify the amount of SNAP benefits and how the benefits relate to emergency room visits for hypoglycemia. We chose hypoglycemia because it is a condition that requires medical attention and because low food intake can cause low blood sugar in those with diabetes. In fact, previous research has demonstrated that food insecurity increases the odds of severe hypoglycemia and interferes with effective diabetes management. In our analysis, we found a strong negative relationship between the size of SNAP benefits and ER visits for hypoglycemia. As the size of the SNAP benefit increased, the likelihood of an ER visit for hypoglycemia went down. We estimate that a $100 increase in SNAP benefits would decrease the overall likelihood of an ER visit for hypoglycemia by about 13%. This research suggests that more generous SNAP benefits could help low-income families manage their food consumption over the month and could potentially lower healthcare costs for families, healthcare facilities, and taxpayers by reducing the number of ER visits for hypoglycemia within the population of Medicaid recipients.
That was Colleen Heflin of the University of Missouri. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. You can also reach us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.